Hello and welcome back to the program. My name is Michael Finney. Today I am joined by author W.C. Turk. Would you like to say hello, sir?
Hello, how are you? And all your listeners. I hope you're everybody as well.
Yeah, very good. So you have a new book out, but let's talk a little bit about you. Tell us where you're from, what you do, your background, anything you feel is important on the topic of being an author or how you developed in writing, where you come from in terms of career, stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm the host of Chicago Writes, the podcast of the Chicago Writers Association, but I've got four published books under my belt that run the gamut from a war memoir to fiction and some dystopian science fiction that I wrote for the Occupy movement a number of years ago, and an investigative piece about the downing of MH17 over Ukraine in 2014, which I used my substantial airline background to investigate globally and beat out the official investigation by 6 months, and was even more accurate in scope than that highly politicized investigation.
Very cool. So you have a background in print publishing, journalism, reporting, that nature.
Yes, I do. So I was a relief worker for Rwanda during the Rwandan genocide. I was a witness to the genocide and wrote a memoir about the genocide and the siege of Sarajevo. And so I was a war photographer there as well. So I've got a substantial background in journalism, but also in print media as well.
How long have you been writing, and where did you get interested in that field or that passion? Where did it start?
You know, I speak with a lot of musicians and ask them that very same question, and they all have, most of them, almost without exception, have the same answer, that it was something that was always a part of them, that they always wanted to do and needed to do. I had written poetry back when I was a visual artist, and you know, I had toyed with writing different stories when I was a kid. But I didn't get serious about it until after I returned from the war in Bosnia.
I have also kind of worked in print publications, some magazines, different rags over the years, wrote in college. I think everybody writes in college, but at the same time was working on the school paper and also a few other periodicals.
There you go. And we've spoken about that in the past, you and I. But I have to say that my first college writing experience in a rhetoric class was nightmarish. And I've kind of turned it into a funny story, but I had a crazy rhetoric teacher who would give us these off the wall topics to write about, and things that you would need to normally research because it just wasn't part of person's natural lexicon or conversation or even knowledge base. And so I would fill, you know, we had to write a page. I would fill the page right with anything I could think of, pertinent or even not pertinent to the subject at hand. And she would always mark me down for excessive wordiness.
Brutal.
And so, so I wrote her a long letter explaining why, with these off-the-wall subjects, the mating habits of the platypus or whatever, you know, these really kind of crazy off-the-wall subjects, why wordiness comes into play when you're trying to fill a whole page, right? She graded it and gave it back to me. But I did get the highest grade of the class, of that class, on that letter that I wrote to her. So,
hey, You know, you figured out her algorithm.
That's right.
So you're a Chicago guy. You do the podcast Chicago Writes. How did you get into that? Where did it come from?
I used to do a radio show called Playtime with Bill Turk and Carrie Kendall, and on a local radio station here, which was immensely popular. We were getting artists and writers from all over the musicians from all over the planet, and garnering a great reputation. Greg Kinn, Martin Barr were guests. Trevor Horn from Yes and the Buggles was we actually woke Trevor up at home in England. But we just had a great community vibe, and I also as a writer I had already published three books, two novels, and four books actually. And I wanted to highlight authors that wouldn't normally get spotlight in the media and encourage them to exercise that media voice, to strengthen that media voice so that they could be more confident in going to sources of media that were less familiar or maybe even hostile or, you know, more corporate-like, and so that they could gain a little bit of acumen and comfort level. And so we had in a number of authors that were associated with the Chicago Writers Association. We were actively building bridges between various types of media. Of the arts, the visual arts and dance arts and music and writing and all that. And I ended up joining the Chicago Writers Association, and they were beginning a podcast. They asked me if I wanted to do it. And this was right after we had ended the radio show, and I was transitioning to podcasting anyways. I love the long format and being able to really spend some time with my guests. We had on all these great guests from all over the world. Sarah Dogan, who was imprisoned by the Turkish government for drawing a picture of an attack on her village, a Turkish army attack on her village for 2.5 years. And so I had to cut those interviews short, you know, to a segment or two segments. I think we ended up doing three segments with Sarah, but that almost took up an entire hour, and that's in between bumpers and commercial breaks, blah blah, and all this.
Right.
So I could actually spend some time with people in podcasts.
Yeah, radio by nature, just because of what's required for the production and promotion and stuff like that on the air, basically interrupts conversations. And, you know, that's just the nature of what it is. I mean, you can't get away from it. They have requirements. But the podcast in general allows people to stretch out and get a little bit deeper. Particularly, I like it as a format. Not only one-on-one, but actually in group settings, I find that to be really valuable, which is why I've been very interested in social audio for the last, you know, 6 years or so. I used to pipe in group chats onto YouTube and Twitter and, you know, a handful of others and broadcast them basically through OBS and pulling some of the API components from Discord into OBS so that there were some on-screen visual components. And I think that in that way, it's much more organic and also a little more Socratic than, you know, a structured segment type of setting, which radio requires. I love talking about that stuff in general, because I did a little bit of radio over the years, and have worked for different media organizations as well. And you kind of have to comply with their scenario, whatever it is. But once you start to do original content, or you start doing series of your own and putting them out, it allows you to kind of stretch out in ways that a platform or an organization doesn't necessarily have the capacity to do.
No, I love it. I spent 10 years in commercial radio and managed a community radio station here in Chicago. And but there's always, you know, there's always those hard breaks and those, you know, the limits and the commercial breaks. And then, you know, between if you're featuring a musician or a musical artist, you have to play at least some of their music and even 30 seconds at either side of a segment cuts in substantially to, you know, to that 10 or 12 or 14 minute segment and limits what you can say. And then, you know, there's on air reads and you have to tease upcoming guests and the next show and, the audience also wants a bit of banter between you and your co-host, particularly, you know, the sort of on-air good-natured hijinks that Carrie and I engaged in, was, you know, that they tuned in for that specifically, and the guests were just icing on the cake. And I can stretch my rhetorical and conversational legs in this medium. And because I feature on my Playtime podcast, I feature a lot of local and national and international musicians. I can play not only their music and highlight, you know, much of a new album, but I can also play some of their influences and even go back deep into their histories and pull up some of that foundational music, which is just a magic aspect of this medium.
Yeah. In terms of formatting, it just allows you to do so much more, not only because of the time, but the freedom to basically composite an experience the way that you want your listeners to have it, you know, and that's a great freedom, I feel like.
Yep. Yeah, it sure is.
So let's talk a little bit about your books. We can either dive right into your most recent release, or you can give us a little bit of background on your publishing experience in terms of the other books and how you got to where you are now, whichever you like.
You know, I'll cover a little bit about the earlier works. So I mentioned Tragic Fate about MH17, which was released as an ebook. It's still on Amazon as an ebook. My first book was something that I had worked on for a number of years. I had been toying with the idea of putting out a memoir about my experiences in Bosnia, but I set that aside, and both my wife and I, who's from Sarajevo, and we met and married in Sarajevo, excuse me, two blocks from the front line, had a sniper come off the line, take the day off to be in our wedding, but we both faced issues of post-traumatic stress from all that we'd experienced. And then, you know, that was also the country was just coming to terms with post-traumatic stress, which for years had been called shell shock or what have you. But after the Gulf War, there was a growing conversation, national conversation about that. So, So to escape the city life here, we were traveling to the UP of Michigan and fell in love with the wilderness up there and fell in love with the Ojibwe spirit that that is underlaid through that entire culture and celebrated. But it wasn't always celebrated. We got some great stories about that. So I wrote a book called Broken, One Soldier's Journey Home, about a Gulf War veteran who returns home. He was the football star with the all paid scholarship, and then he breaks his leg in the big game, loses his scholarship, and ends up in the Army and on the front lines in Iraq. And he faces some significant traumas, psychological traumas from that. And he meets an old man that lives out on this great big island out in Lake Superior called Grand Island. It's beautiful, beautiful wilderness island. And this old man lives in the old Ojibwe ways and claims to be a survivor of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. So my character Danny sets out to solve the mystery of this old man as a means of helping himself out of this universal lack of distrust and faith and his own brokenness. He ends up traveling around Lake Superior to a very real place where a real lifeboat of the Edmund Fitzgerald washed up on shore. One of the few pieces of debris that were found from the wreck shortly after that. But it's just a beautiful, faithful story in which I get to celebrate not only Ojibwe spiritualism and religion, but the incredible wilderness and environment of the Lake Superior shore. So then right after that, we had some success with that. I self-published a war memoir, Everything for Love, and then got involved with the Occupy movement and created a piece for the movement to generate some income along with a play that I wrote and produced that got some national attention for the Occupy movement called The Last Man, a rather dystopian view of a world run by a corporation. I've been writing and writing and writing, and I've got a lot of manuscripts, but this new book, The Assassination of Baby Hitler, a love story — I have to add the love story, otherwise it sounds a little violent — but The Assassination of Baby Hitler, a love story, just fell into my lap, as it were, and here we are today, man.
What do you want to tell us about this new book that we should know without giving it away?
Yeah. It's essentially about a book about a man who falls in love with an older woman, which just so happens that she's 130 years older than he is. If you like older women. That would be the top tier, I would guess. But Darby Armstrong is a physics professor at a small town community college who gets thrown back into 1891 Bavaria, where he meets Greta, who's the girl of his dreams, and a time auger who accuses Darby of wanting to kill baby Hitler. And so the chase is on morally and scientifically, romantically and physically across 19th century Bavaria, which was fun, by the way, because I've spent so much time in Germany and and Bavaria and Munich, that I got to recreate it in the 19th century. It was so much fun.
Yeah, obviously, I am also passionate about that era, not necessarily Bavaria or Germany, but the decade as it relates to Chicago. And we've talked a bit about that. We don't have to go into that, but I do like the aspect of time travel here. What kind of mechanics did you use? You know, there are different types of time travel. Some people like one more than another. Sometimes it's soft mechanics, soft science. Other times it's harder science, more grounded. Where are you coming from in this book?
Oh, this is definitely a hard science, but with a little bit of a lighthearted twist. Honestly, I grew up on science fiction, which is the gateway to actual science, or gateway drug to actual science, right? Or maybe the gateway drug to philosophy and dreaming. But I think that audiences now are more educated, more better read, more sophisticated, and aren't satisfied with magic rocks or flux capacitors or falling asleep and waking up in a different time. This is the real science, theoretical and real, of time travel. So Darby has to, when he finds himself in 1891, he has to use inductive and deductive reasoning to figure out first if this isn't, if he's not unconscious or near death, and this isn't part of that process of dying, and when he comes to a realization through time and through some quantitative reasoning that this is real, then he begins relying on his physics background to come up with a hypothesis and then a theory as to how he got there and how he can get home.
Does he even want to get home after he's fallen in love?
He realizes, well, first of all, he realizes that he doesn't know nearly enough about history as he should, and that really it's a whole world that exists, and the people in it are real and have lives and motivations, and the path to the future is not so clear from this perspective as it is looking back, right? And so he understands he doesn't know quite how to live in this time. He might have to if he gets stuck, and he has Greta, but that there's a lot of what ifs that he has to overcome. Now, so you were talking about this decade of the 19th century, where not a lot of monumental historical events occurred, but it was also a time of this great scientific awakening, especially in Western Europe and Germany and France and Switzerland. And so he begins to craft what he might do if he's in fact stuck there. Schrodinger was just a child at the time, but maybe he'll go and talk to Schrodinger about his cat. Maybe he'll go to Vienna and see all these other scientists who are working on these various fields, which will all come together in the future and may or may not lead to a better understanding of time, but will absolutely lead to many of the the scientific accoutrements and technologies that he's come to find, and maybe he can change history in that way.
So you've set this up as a series, and I'm curious if the Accidental Time Traveler series is about just Darby, or if there are other people that will become accidental time travelers. You don't have to give anything away if you don't want to, but is it episodic, or is it more continuous story about one character?
So book two is Greta's story. I spoke earlier about my wife and I being separated during the siege of Sarajevo, and I had to escape. She was of military age, so we had to find a different way to get her out. So that kind of alludes to a bit of a spoiler for the first book. The second book is her story, loosely based upon my wife being able to escape from Sarajevo, but still remaining in the Balkans for more than a year. And so I've set this up with Greta not quite making it back to Darby's time. And she has to come to terms with everything that she experiences in this time. And what happens if she's unable to jump forward in time to be with Darby, and she grows old, much older than he is, and half a world away. So that sets up that story. Also, in keeping with the Bosnia theme, when I was there, I understood that I had a greater responsibility to tell the truth about what I saw in the Balkans. And I was on all sides of the conflict, except for that last 5 or 6 months when I was trapped on the Bosnian side. But that perspective is really important, and I have a much greater understanding of 20, 30 years in about the war. And so in book three, Darby has a responsibility, and I set it up towards the end of the first book and more fully in the second book. The third book is all about what he's learned and the warning he has for the world about unrestricted or uncontrolled time travel. Which is I'm not giving away too much, but in the first book he's thinking through a lot of these different scenarios. Why doesn't he see if time travel proliferates in the future and in the far future or even near future? If it proliferates, why don't you see time traveling ninjas out to assassinate the pooping potentate Hitler, or SWAT teams, time traveling SWAT teams, you know, out to vanquish the ninjas for Nazis or whatever? So, you know, why doesn't a guy with a laser weapon show up on Omaha Beach and change the course of battle, right? But we don't see those things. We don't that incomprehensible discontinuity to time just doesn't happen. So maybe this book, or this trilogy getting published, has an effect as Darby crafts and tries to compel world leaders to craft an international convention on time travel. About that.
Interesting. I want to go a little broader now in general. Mm-hmm. And talk about your experience with the publishing industry in general, and how this book is getting distribution or how your experiences with your other books have gone. Anything that you feel is important there?
So all of my other books were, which were self-published, were word of mouth. It was based upon my own promotion and people stumbling upon it and reading the book. So I did very, very well with Broken. I sold big in Germany and big in India. We found out from a trip a few years back to the UP that there were a lot of Indians that came with the book as tourists to this is for Broken, as tourists for based upon the book. They wanted to be so. Which just astounded me. It astounded me that a book about the American heartland and something as legendary as the Edmund Fitzgerald would resonate with Indians from India and would compel some of them to come and want to see those places. It was breathtaking to me. So I did, you know, I posted on Facebook now and then, and you know, I've talked up the books, but that was pretty much the end all and be all of my marketing strategy for those first several books. Whenever there was something about the war in Ukraine that was pertinent, or you know, Hunter Biden, because I had a chapter about Burisma and Joe Biden. This is back in 2014. In a tragic fate, you know, that I would post the book and get a little, you know, get a little a few hits here and there. So, this book is the first book with a traditional publisher. It's Renegade Press LLC out of Appleton, Wisconsin, and a great publisher named Dan Davies. It's a small boutique publisher, but it's perfect for me. I got to edit the book and write the book and say in the book precisely what I wanted to say, and I had control over the cover and the editorial aspect of that. So there's some give and take there, right? What I gained in the editorial rights, and I lost a little bit in the amount of money that Renegade Press can throw at book promotion. But they've done a really nice job and tireless job of promoting the book so far. So because of their promotion and their strategy, we hit number one in Gilded Age Romance in Amazon for the ebook, and number three in Alternative History, and then we were in the top 50 for a while, new releases. So I'm just thrilled and overwhelmed by what they've done for the book so far, and it's still generating some decent interest on the web, on Amazon. So then May 20th the paperback book comes out, and then on June 6th, the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the audiobook comes out, and I'm really, really proud of that as well.
And you're working on the audiobook yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think people will just be knocked out about it. So, and I've taken a page from you, Mike, where you've produced some work with an audio component, or with a sound component, sound effect component behind your spoken words. And so there's a little bit of immersive sound in the book, just these tiny little accents. But I think it really makes for a really powerful audiobook. So I'm very excited about it. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you did the reading. I'm glad to hear that you're making it a little more immersive, dynamic with sound effects or music or all the things that you're placing in there.
Well, you know, so there's this aspect of it. There are programs, AI programs, that you can feed your book into, and within 20 minutes or so, it'll generate an audio book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. First of all, I'm very big on, I'm a theater guy, so I'm very big on energy and emotion. And I know how these characters think, and I know how I want them to sound and react, right? So there's that emotion, that syntax that is all important to a character and how a character will speak. So it's not just an up and down motion based upon an exclamation point or a question mark, but it's really emoting, even chuckling through a few words. So it's adding that really true human quality, not only to the larger narrative, but to the dialogue and the conversation in that. And I think that will resonate very strongly with the audience.
Well, no one's going to know the context like the author, right?
Precisely.
Though, you know, I do obviously use AI quite a bit across the board, all kinds of different tools and stuff like that. And I find it to be useful to a degree. You know, there are some platforms that are better than others, but at the same time, you know, you have to really work at them. And in some cases, it might just be easier just to do it yourself. And instead of continually prompting and trying to dig out of the algorithm what it is that you're looking for, it might not have enough metadata to make that connection for you.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. I think this is the time when we really need to define, before AI gets too far out of reach. And I'm not talking about some destructive or, you know, all, but before it gets too out of reach of the ability for people to comprehend that people are behind a lot of this creation, right? So by asserting this in the audiobook, I'm also making a statement about the necessity for the human voice.
Absolutely. Cannot agree more. Are there any things that we haven't touched on yet that you feel are important to address in regards to your book, being a writer, being an author, which to me is about promoting your releases and really getting out there, doing podcast appearances, you know, things like that?
Well, I really feel a need to do a shout out to Jeb Bush, who made a completely inane and immoral statement back in 2016. When he said that if he could go back in time, he would kill baby Hitler. That question set up an interesting moral argument about evil and process, and knowing what we know now, does that justify murdering an innocent little baby? That led to the creation of this book. So thanks, Jeb. But yeah, so this is, you know, books are your way of explaining to the world what you think about that world. But even more so, and this is the reason that I think that AI can never really truly take over for the human voice, is that every single piece of literature, every single work of art is ultimately about love and the assertion of love, or the importance of love and loss. And until a machine is capable of of that love, I don't think that will ever truly be replaced.
Well, WC, I appreciate you taking the time to hang out and talk, promoting the book, The Assassination of Baby Hitler, getting a little more background on your career and different projects that you work on. You keep busy, for sure. We have a lot of overlap and similarity there.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure speaking with you, Michael. Absolutely. As always.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we, you know, this is what, maybe the third or fourth time we've talked over the last few years. So I'm glad to be able to return the favor and bring you in.
Yeah. I can tell you, when I was in radio, I wish I had those pipes, man.
You know, it's all the microphone. That's, it does all the work.